because in the last couple of days I've been working a little bit too hard because we're going on vacation tomorrow. And the work I do is sort of flexible and intangible. I have goals and I'm talking to the client about what I'm working on, but you know, I can't realistically promise any particular thing done at any particular time. And yet somehow sometimes the mind really fixates, you know, on getting to a certain point, regardless of any sort of consideration of how much time it'll take. Which just seems to be sort of the lesson I need to learn over and over again. The lesson about steadiness in work. Not focusing so much on any particular result, but just to work steadily. But anyway, I was getting really caught, and especially this afternoon, I was quite caught by the desire to produce and create and prove myself and all these things. And getting tense in the shoulders and sort of feeling that sort of psychic, sort of turtle feeling that one feels when one's sort of trying too hard. I was doing good work, actually, but with this sort of extra cost and extra overhead. And I never would have come to, I was just realizing, standing there, I never would have come to Zazen if I didn't feel obligated to come. I would have, like, tried to get a little more work done and started packing for the trip and run around a lot. And so I was really feeling grateful because it's, and sort of amazed anew at the way something this simple could be so effective at that kind of psychic unbending, that kind of healing from clinging. When I first sat down for Zazen, I felt, you know, naturally tense in the body and resistant to Zazen, and so I was thinking, you know, we should really do some stretching first. What a stupid, you know, system we have. You know, we just sit here all stiff. And by the end, I thought, you know, even if it doesn't make any sense, you know, Zazen just works, you know, and Qin Hin together with Zazen is a powerful combination that we could do well to pay more attention to the power of sitting down and then with the spirit of continuity of practice, bringing that sense of mindfulness and concentration into walking slowly. It's so beautiful. So anyway, I really want to recommend feeling a sense of obligation in practice. It might be that practice requires us to feel obligated. And I don't know if there's some organizational way we can obligate each other to come to practice. It would probably be good, you know. And maybe that's why practice period seems to be helpful. We agree to obligate each other and obligate ourselves during practice period. But really, we need that all the time. Tempered with realism of what we can do and what we have time for, we need to feel probably some sense of obligation. Because when we need practice most is when we don't want to come. You know, it's when we really don't want to come. So we need that decision to not be in that usual category. So anyway, that's just a little prologue. So I'll be gone the next 2 weeks. Next week I was going to talk to John and John later, or whoever wants to. I'm not sure what will happen next Wednesday, something good. The week after that, John Wiley will give a Dharma talk. And also other announcements. This Saturday morning is the third Saturday morning, and I've checked, and people will be here for sure. There'll be at least two Enos and a Tenzo, and 6:30 a.m. Very beautiful here, very quiet. Maybe you should feel obligated to come to that, even if you don't want to get out of bed. 6 in the morning, yeah, on Saturday. Did I? Sorry, 6. 6 o'clock on Saturday. And you're totally out of here with the yummy breakfast in your tummy by about 8:30. So there's a lot of day left. The talk I wanted to give out of practical necessity, as you gathered, I didn't have time to prepare a talk. So I thought I would give the same talk, more or less, that I gave at our one-day Sesshin a week and a half ago. which went really well, if you weren't well. So a few of us have heard this talk before, and most of us haven't. It was a very beautiful session. Hopefully we'll get to do that again. And the talk is about, the title I put is The Fruits of Practice. And it's about how hard it is to sort of see or understand or feel what the result of practice is in ourselves. So in this talk, I want to look at the example of somebody else, somebody who's practiced for a long time. In this case, a Zen teacher who's practiced for more than 40 years, because this teacher, whose name is Mel Weitzman, Sojin Mel Weitzman, he ended up being an important sort of, not last exactly, but sort of finishing teacher for quite a few American Zen teachers, about 20, where they started their training with other people and then ended up completing Dharma transmission and the study that leads up to Dharma transmission with Mel. And so Mel just turned 80 years old. And in another talk I read to the Sangha, an appreciation by Norman Fisher, who was one of those students who worked with Mel to complete his formal training. But it turned out that talk by Norman Fisher in tribute of Mel and his 80th birthday was one of many, and it was part of a book. I didn't know that at the time. It's a really beautiful book called Umbrella Man. Umbrella Man. And you have to get the book to find out why it's called Umbrella Man. I won't tell you. And so it's all of his surviving Dharma transmission students, 18 I think, two had died, writing their appreciations of Mel. And so what I did was I read through the book a few times and I picked out some themes. There were some obvious themes in the book. And I wrote down quotations from all these different students and teachers, students of Mel, teachers of Zen, on these themes, but I'm not going to attribute the quotes so the talk flows smoothly. So I'm going to read to you the name of a theme, according to me, and then one or two quotes from these other teachers about how this particular long-term practitioner, Mel Weitzman, you know, embodied that quality in some way. And it's also interesting to notice what's missing, you know, what qualities are not talked about, which we'll reflect on at the end. And then after the talk, maybe just a little bit of whole group discussion. We won't do, I think, the pairs or small group thing this time, partly because I want to get out of here and pack. But I'm less anxious about it. Thanks to Zazen. I still want to get my butt out of here. We're supposed to leave tomorrow. Anyway. And then one historical note about this is because it's referenced in the quotes, inevitably, is most of these people writing were members of San Francisco Zen Center, founded by Suzuki Roshi, our lineage, big center with free practice places. And Mel himself is the abbot of Berkeley Zen Center across the bay, which is a place that stayed small, a little bit bigger than this, but not a lot, not a lot bigger. And most of the people had been studying with Richard Baker, the successor of Suzuki Roshi at San Francisco Zen Center, who, as you probably know, famously sort of flamed out in the mid-80s. And so that's in the background a little bit. People had been working with Dick Baker, and then they later ended up working with Mel, which was not like anybody's plan. It just worked out that way. So, an appreciation of Mel Weitzman. Steadiness, devotion, and endurance. It seems to me that the main characteristic of Suzuki Roshi's teaching and of Soto Zen is faith and steadiness and endurance to keep going with the practice no matter what. As Dogen taught so profoundly, the practice is enlightenment. There is no enlightenment outside of practice. In the early days, and I know it's the same now, it was clear without anyone needing to say so that this was the value most encouraged by Mel. There was sitting every morning at 5 a.m. And Mel was there every day, always on time. Whether there was one person or two or three joining him, and there were seldom more than three or four in the early days, he would always be there, sitting in his place at the head of the stairs, so that when you walked up the stairs, you would see him first, just there, always there, motionless and quiet. Generous and steadfast. And he was steadfast. Now that I look back at those years when he was there in the hinterlands, and the big Zen thing was happening in San Francisco, and Mel was quietly running his smaller center in Berkeley, he just steadfastly practiced, taught, and followed his way, followed Suzuki Roshi's way. Just a tremendous steadfast quality and not fancy. Mel is not a very fancy kind of person, no frills. Very different from the flavor of the way Richard Baker taught. Humble. Associated with all this is tremendous humility. When Steve Stuckey, Paul Haller, and I did Dharma transmission with Mel in 1993, each of us had to do a series of ceremonies. After the final Dharma talk, we went to Suzuki Roshi's ashes site up on the Hogback, so where Suzuki Roshi's ashes are buried. Thanks. Some of them. We offered incense and bowed, and Mel was standing in front of Suzuki Roshi, and the three of us were a little further back. Thanks. Mel looked at us and said, you know, this is a very pregnant moment, right? The Dharma transmission ceremony takes a week, and it's like sort of continuous effort. And for some reason, the tradition is the most important parts of the ceremony are done in the middle of the night, like literally, like 1, 2 a.m. in the morning. So you're really tired, I would think, and you know, you've been through this huge thing, and now you're at the memorial site of Suzuki Roshi. So you can imagine that feeling. We stood there, and Mel looked at us and said, "I'm not so good, but you are good," and went on to say that passing on the Dharma to us was a good thing, and that we would manifest it in a good way. Good things would happen. This statement, "I'm not so good, but you're good," is one of the most important things that anyone has ever said to me. Not because it makes me good, but because the quality of humility is so authentic. When I teach and practice now, I hope I convey that spirit. Letting go of results. The evolution of my sense of Zazen is a lot about polishing a tile, challenging the whole idea that you're going to get somewhere or get something out of it. Now I'm not as focused on getting something or being in some particular way. In Zazen or in general, I'm not as focused on that as I used to be. I realize wherever I am, it's not going to be so good. It's not going to be the way I wanted, so I might as well get used to it. Dogen said, "Those who have great realization of delusion are Buddha." Those who have great realization of delusion are Buddha. You know there's no place to go. The place where you get to be a Buddha, so to speak, is in delusion, and there's plenty to go around. And you get up where you fall down. I like to talk about that too. You get up where you fall down. You know, where else would you get up? You don't get up somewhere else. It's where you fall down that you establish your practice. That's what Mel manifested when he talked to me during our training. Supportive and open and friendly and helpful, just assisting me in getting up where I fell down. And the first line of that, the evolution of my sense of Zazen is a lot about polishing a tile, is a koan reference. So let me mention that story to you. If you've probably heard this story. It's from China. So there's a student who's really determined, meditation student. You know, really feels obligated, you know, overly obligated. Always sitting zazen, and you know, during the all it comes to all the regular periods, but also during the breaks, you know, and treats every day like sesshin and is always practicing, you know, constantly sitting zazen. And then one day, the teacher comes along, and he was sitting on the outside of the zendo. There's like usually a porch on the outside, so maybe he's sitting on this porch on the outside, called the engawa in Japanese. Because the teacher picked up a roof tile, so they must have been like working on the roof, you know, those ceramic tiles. So the teacher picks up a roof tile and gets out his handkerchief and starts rubbing the tile with it, standing like right in the face of the student sitting zazen so assiduously. Just rubbing this roof tile. And finally, the student gets exasperated. And you know, says, "Well, why are you polishing the tile like that?" And the teacher says, "I'm making a mirror. I'm making a mirror out of this tile." And the student says, "You can't polish a tile into a mirror. That's not possible." And the teacher says something like, "Well, you can't make a Buddha by sitting zazen like that." It's the same thing. So that's a famous story that's about the student is Zhao Zhou, who goes on to be also a famous Chinese master later, and the teacher is his teacher Nanchuan. So that's a good story for us. We need to be obligated, but we don't need to try to polish a tile into a mirror. So, the next quality. Just being upright. Once I was studying my tendency to be regarded as a good guy by everyone. You know that tendency? I asked Mel, "I know the true Dharma goes beyond the duality of good and bad, but isn't it valid to choose the good?" After a brief pause, Mel looked me in the eye and said, "Our practice is being upright." Just being upright. Connecting to the feeling of practice. You know, not just the idea, the feeling of practice. When Mel was the abbot, he at one point went over to San Francisco Zen Center to help them as the abbot. When Mel was the abbot and I was the Eno, managing the Zendo, I wanted to clarify one of the details of Kinhin. So I asked Mel, "Okay, when do we hit the clackers?" He looked at me with conviction and said, "Hit them when it feels right." That was his notion of precision. Not just a notion of precision, but an invitation to attend to precision, the precision of being in tune with the whole activity. That story always makes me think of these detailed scripts we have. We don't have everything scripted. We always want to have more things scripted. We have some things quite well scripted, which I think is good. It makes it more possible for people to jump in and try these things. And Don did a lovely job with about 2 minutes training hitting the Han because we have it all scripted. But the thing is, it's not really about following the script. Eventually, you need to feel it in your body. And unfortunately, the scripts also have mistakes in them, you know, which I keep not getting around to fixing, maybe on purpose. You know, it's good to have flawed scripts. Anyway, connecting to the feeling of practice. Working with difficulties. When significant difficulties arose at Berkeley Zen Center, how they were handled was admirable. In a direct way, his senior students were always saying, or were saying, "Hey Mel, what are you doing?" Without defensiveness, he'd respond, "Oh, you're right." But he didn't say, "Okay, well, then you can't be my student." And they didn't say, "Well, you can't be our teacher." Mel had trained them and worked with them in a way that whatever the issue, their relationship could be sustained, and they worked it through. Good training for us, which is definitely our hope here. We can have that feeling of understanding and sense of safety. It's like Jeff bringing us the full value contract. It's the same idea. Ordinariness. For me, Sojin Roshi's genius is in his ordinariness. Once at a big hospice fundraising dinner at Green's Restaurant in San Francisco, which is a pretty fancy restaurant, everyone would be dressed up, Ram Dass was the guest speaker. I knew that Sojin would be making a speech right after him. Ram Dass was a famous spiritual teacher. I began to wonder what Sojin would do. How would he express himself to all these potential donors and people from the wider community? When his turn came, Sojin got up and spoke to the crowd, just like he always spoke. The same old Sojin. The same one I know in the Zendo, in the Doksan room, and at Zen Center staff meetings. It's hard to put into words how much Sojin's lack of desire to make a big impression on others impressed me. It's easy to say, just accept who you are, or as Suzuki Roshi said, when you are completely you, Zen is Zen. But it is rare to have a living model of this. I am very grateful to Sojin for his embodiment of this teaching. And from this first encounter, I was inspired by what I took to be Mel's ordinariness. He wasn't trying to impress anybody or stand out in any way. He seemed like a very ordinary, accessible person. And yet, in that ordinariness was something that meant a lot to me. It seemed to me that he was the first person I'd met who was settled and at peace with himself. I saw in Mel a form of everyday, straightforward Zen practice that didn't make Zen into something esoteric or mysterious. Appreciating disagreement. Mel wanted to know how I understood my relationship to him. I told him I trusted him implicitly, but I didn't know if I agreed completely with his Dharma understanding. To my amazement, he stopped. They were walking along. He stopped, turned to me, and said in a very direct, welcoming way, something like, "Great, where we disagree is where we can meet." I believe he also brought his hands together to emphasize that meeting. Being yourself. More than anyone else, I see Suzuki Roshi in Mel's face. I myself tried for several years to be Suzuki Roshi. "It's okay that you've died," I thought. "You can have my life." But I ended up abandoning myself when I tried to practice that way. But Mel is just Mel. And there's Suzuki Roshi. Deep listening. After my Dharma transmission, I said to Sojin, "Remember, I'm not going to start a Zen group. That's not what I do." He didn't say anything. A few years later, after I had started a Zen group, and it was thriving, I was again talking with Sojin, and I reminded him with a little embarrassment of my earlier comment. "I guess you must have known something back then that I didn't," I said. He replied, "Oh, I don't listen to what people say." Right. What he meant was, I don't listen to what people say. I listen to what people say. And I've tried to do that in my own work as a priest. Another one about listening. I felt deeply known, seen, and accepted by Mel. He was interested. He listened. I was totally neurotic at the time and had so many problems. Yet his mind was so wide that whatever yammering was happening in my mind would just float away into the ether as I talked. After 5 minutes of talking to him, my gigantic problems, of which I had many, floated away in his big mind. There was nothing else to say, so we'd just sit there, quiet and content. He never answered. He never solved anything. I couldn't have articulated this at the time, but I was going there to be with his mind. I would talk for 5 or 10 minutes, and then we'd be quiet, and I'd sit in his spaciousness. Which I'm little by little learning that's sort of the best thing we have to offer other people from our practice, that sense of space. Being with others, or teaching with others. In relationship with people who came to study the Dharma with me, I can see now how deeply I've been shaped by Sojin Roshi's way. Om grow up, svaha. That's this teacher's mantra. Om grow up, svaha. Take seriously your life as it is. Make it a Buddha field of generosity and mutuality. Sit zazen, be honest with yourself and others. Don't fall for fancy ideas about practice. Keep at it. As a teacher, you can rely on me to show up and share my understanding, but not to tell you what to do. It is up to you to realize the way. Find joy in the feel of your feet on the floor. Live in your world. This is some of what I received from Mel. It is my life's work to live out all I have been given. Another one about being straightforward. Being straightforward. Sojin values and embodies directness. He cuts through delusion, no hesitation. My experience is that this comes directly from Zazen. He is quite willing to tell me my stuff, to show me my shadow. Usually he is right. It is sometimes painful to hear, but helpful. Once I have been harboring ill will towards a dear friend and could not let it go. I found I kept trying to convince her that she was wrong about an exchange and that it had hurt me deeply. Finally, I went to Sojin and told him about my difficulty in letting the matter drop. His response, can't you just say ouch and move on? And as is my practice with him, I said yes and left. Sort of implying she didn't know how she was going to do that, but she said yes. Then I practiced with it. I found that I had neither voiced nor let myself experience the ouch. And so I did, first experiencing it myself, and then meeting with my friend and sharing the hurt part. She apologized. We both dropped it and moved on. Working honestly with faults. I've seen Sojin Roshi when he was accused of crossing boundaries. This happened with gay students at Tassajara Monastery and with women students at Berkeley at different times. What impressed me was how open Sojin was with the students who confronted him. Somehow he managed to demonstrate humility and yet not be servile. He always maintained his dignity and authority. About a year ago in Shosan, which is like a formal question and answer ceremony, somebody asked him what his greatest difficulty as a teacher was. Without hesitation, he said, I tend to fall in love with my female students. I work with this by trying to think of them as my sisters. I was deeply moved by his honesty. Boredom is okay. Or maybe boredom is good. Over the years, Mel's presentation of the Dharma has often put me to sleep. I aspire to this. Too much trying to be interesting. Until he puts me to sleep, until the unique quality of his teaching begins to permeate my bones. And then I wake up. deeply nourished. He would talk about the virtues of ordinary, conventional life, and he would go through the teachings word by word, reading them again and again. When Mel and I would meet for Dokusan, private interview, every so often, I began to notice that whenever I started going on and on about my problems, he would fall asleep. Often right in the middle of presenting an important emotional reaction to something that had happened, I would gradually notice him nodding. Sometimes he would open his eyes very wide to try to stay awake, to try to stay with me. But when my voice became authentic and fresh, he would completely wake up. This boring approach taught me an important lesson about how to meet Dharma and life when a situation or a person presents itself in an unresolved, undeveloped way. One can meet it with a matter-of-fact, self-nourishing patience. Mel's Dharma is to offer a few words, but then stay until awakening occurs. I like that phrase that the person wrote. One can meet it with a matter-of-fact, self-nourishing patience. For some reason, I really find this last quote really helpful. Working with my desire to be exciting or something. I think we all have this impulse to be clever, to be interesting, to give good advice, to be right, but to let ourselves be boring and ordinary, just to listen and attend to the moment. Giving space is a good teaching for us, good for me. So I want to read you my somewhat arbitrary list of qualities again I pulled out of this book. And let's talk for a minute about what's not there. Steadiness, devotion, and endurance. Generosity, being steadfast, humble, letting go of results, being upright, connecting to the feeling, working with difficulties, being ordinary, being yourself, appreciating disagreement, and not trying to be someone else, deep listening, teaching others, being straightforward, working honestly with faults, and boredom is okay. I'm going to change that for the future to boredom is good. And then we can think about what we project on ourselves, what we desire from ourselves, and what we desire and project upon our teachers. Nobody talked about how Mel was always right about them. One person said that Mel would be incisive about her shadow side. Other people said they didn't agree with Mel, or didn't get any advice from Mel. So people did not, the consensus was not anything about being right. Or being smart, or brilliant, or insightful. Instead, they talked about steadiness, devotion to practice. Nothing flashy or impressive, being ordinary. Settling, so one might say, settling in to our life, accepting the moment that arises fully, without, embellishment or resistance, working with things. And through some strange chain of circumstances, we have the opportunity to do the exact same practice. that Sojin Roshi, whom I think probably no one but me here has actually even met, but that's okay, to join him in steady practice of Zazen and extending that feeling out into our life. Returning regularly to this so supportive container, like I was appreciating tonight, and not diffusing our energy any more than our karma mandates, not getting any more confused than we have to. And if we do have hard times, which we will, to have in our body some feeling cultivated quietly over a long time that we can touch and turn to help us remember. And to have some faith that just by being ordinary and fully being ourselves, we can be so helpful to others. That rather than trying harder to be just the right kind of person, figuring out what we need to do, there's a way we can slip under that impulse and find the most helpful person. And the other way this is important, I think, we're reminded by the fact that it was Sojin's 80th birthday, so who knows how much longer he'll live. And then also, before Zazen, I went down to the office and I looked in my box, and there was a mailer from a fellow offering discount funeral and cremation services. I don't know about discount, reasonable, it says a reasonable discount. Sounds pejorative, I don't know what he's doing. And I was reminded that this essential fact in the background always that we are so good at forgetting about our own mortality. And that one way to look at practice is preparation for that last hour of our life. And we know that there will be a last hour. And in that last hour, can we give our life away? Can we give teachings and healing to ourselves and our loved ones, whether they're with us or far away? And a practical point is, if you would like me to do your funeral, you should let me know. I realize, you know, one of the things that a community should know about each other. We don't have any sort of legal power. It'll be your family that steps in, whoever they are. I'm sure there are wills and documents one is supposed to have that probably none of us have gotten around to. Okay, well, John can tell us how to do it. Because we're going to leave behind, you know, a few hundred pounds of stuff. And so it's helpful to let everyone know what you want done with it, you know. And how you would like to be celebrated. And so anyway, I thought of that. Not to be... It's funny, whenever you talk about death, you always want to apologize. You know, why is that? You know, like, I was about to say, I'm not sorry to be so morbid. Like, well, you know, what is that? You know, is that just sort of, you know, supporting our resistance to death? You know, we say that. You know? I don't need to do anybody's funeral, but I'm happy to do so if you'd like me to. And if I know that, even if it's not written down, then I can at least tell somebody and maybe something will happen. Well, that's my talk on the fruits of practice. Do you have any comments or thoughts?
Is the book available?
I bought it directly from San Francisco Zen Center.
Sorry.
And I don't, yeah, I'm sure you could too, yeah.
That sounds great.
It is a really great book, yeah. I really think it would be a good one to read.
I just like, I don't know if you made up the list, but that's a great list of qualities.
Yeah, I made up the list. Yeah. But it kind of jumps out at you on the pages, yeah. Because you, about halfway through, I had this idea, because it kept being, you know, different stories and different personalities and different details, but it was like the same theme. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Did you mention that you met
Yaw? Yeah, he helped lead one of the practice periods I did at Green Gulch Farm down there, and then another time I went back down there for Sashin that he led, so I practiced with him a couple of times. He probably doesn't remember me, but I remember him.
Personal reflections?
Yeah, well, yeah, he was really good at sort of making sort of warm contact with everybody around him. I was working in the, one of the times that I met him, I was working in the kitchens. And like kitchens everywhere, you're kind of back there somewhere, you know what I mean? The three or four, you're making food for 100 people, and they're all out there doing their thing. And I remember when he was just coming for something that evening, like coming to give a talk that evening or something, he made a point of like walking through the kitchen. I think he gave us like some plums or something from his plum tree and said hello. And he didn't make a big deal of it, you know what I mean? He didn't like want to make sure that I knew his name. You know what I mean? He just like said, hi everybody, you know, thank you for cooking dinner, here's some plums, you know. Kept on about his business. That's one thing I remember. And another thing I remember is, I must have done a couple of sesshin with him, because I remember there was one sesshin where if you want to go to Doksan, you had to sign up, you know. Like we've been having for a long time now, I guess, we've been having the Jisha come and invite you, so you don't have to think about, you know, should I sign up now, tomorrow? When would be the best time? And I sort of like never got around to signing up, so I never met with him, you know. And then a few days later in the hall or something, I mentioned that to him, and I said, I'm sorry I never went to Doksan. And it was so okay with him, you know what I mean? There was not the least bit of like, well, you kind of missed a chance there, buddy, you know what I mean? There was like so zero of that, you know, that impressed me. He's like, oh, you know. He was sympathetic that I felt bad about something, but he didn't seem to have any personal, you know, investment in the story, you know. So that was one thing. All that comes to mind right now.
I just like the idea of being really good at being ordinary.
Yeah. Yeah.
Something very appealing.
Yeah. You're pretty good at that, actually.
I was struck by that. Well, actually, you ended up saying it in your conclusions. Nobody was claiming how brilliant he was.
Yeah.
No stars flashing when he gave a talk or when he met with them or anything. He really seemed to embody what. I take it that he was with Suzuki Roshi.
Yeah, so he was ordained by Suzuki Roshi, one of two or three, not too many. You know, he didn't have time to ordain very many people before he died. And Suzuki Roshi told him, apparently Suzuki Roshi told him, why don't you go, maybe he was from Berkeley, or I forget what the Berkeley connection was, but Suzuki Roshi told him to go open a Zen center in Berkeley, and so he did, you know. He and his wife got a house with a suitable, like, attic, I think. And I never met it. One thing that puzzles me a little about all the Mel stories is you don't hear much about his wife, you know, I don't know. You know, what that is, or if it was partly a sort of a sign of the times, you know, or that she is just like such an incredible bodhisattva, you've never heard of her, you know what I mean? You know what I mean? If she was just quietly in the background supporting this, or if she's been like annoyed at Mel for the last 45 years for like all these strangers in her house, you know, like Janet, at one point I had the idea of like, well, maybe I could turn, we have like a pretty good sized shop, kind of detached garage, you know. Be about this size, a little smaller maybe. And at one point I thought, well, why don't we just make this end? It was when some of the old Dharma Hall politics were driving me nuts, you know what I mean? And so I said to Jen, well, why don't we just make a Zen center here, you know? And she's like, no way, you know, she laughed. So I wonder about Mel's wife and what her role was. One day I really need to meet her and thank her, you know. We all do, but anyway, so yeah, in Suzuki Rishi sort of sent him to do that, and so he did, you know what I mean? In such a thorough way, you know, without, you know, so he would have been at their monastery for maybe a couple of years and, you know, had maybe practiced, I don't know, you know, something like 5 to 10 years. Many of you here have practiced 5 to 10 years, you know, how would you, you know, why don't you go to Missoula and open a Zen center, you know, and sit every morning at 5 in the morning for 20 or 30 years and see if it works out, you know what I mean? How would you do, you know? Maybe you'd do great. So that's kind of, yeah, his spirit. But the other thing, I don't want to make it sound like, I don't want to imply that Richard Baker Roshi was like a bad teacher, in spite of the fact that he had his sort of big problems. Many people down there used to tell me what an incredible teacher he was, you know, like kind of the opposite of this. But that can be helpful too, you know, very insightful, you know, just like, can see right through you, and you don't see him that often, but when you see him, he's just like right at the point that you need to hear. And I remember one, I think it was Blanche Hartman, who's one of the teachers there, I remember she saying that, her saying that she came to practice, she was a little older than the other ones in the early 70s, late 60s. You know, they were all like 20, 22, you know, and that's the other thing about these early sort of American Zen centers, you know, it was really done on the basis of very intense, you know, 20-something energy, you know. And anyway, so this one woman was in her middle 40s, you know. And so she felt kind of old and out of it, and she was always trying really hard. She, you know, kind of not that consciously to impress everybody and show that she could do it too. And maybe some sort of sexual, you know, male-female karma involved in some way, I don't know. She's a very strong, powerful woman. And anyway, I remember her saying she went to Baker Roshi one time, and he said, without much preamble at all, he said, Blanche, from now on, don't do this for somebody else. You need to stop that, you know. And rings a little bell and kicked her out, you know what I mean? And, you know, and she was really surprised and it's like, I'm doing this, what does he mean? And then she walked out and looked around at the other people and realized that, you know, the last 5 years or something, she'd been nothing but trying to impress other people, you know what I mean? And it just really turned that for her. And so maybe Mel's way would just be to wait another 10 years and see if you catch on, I don't know. So there's can be something helpful, I think, to dramatic, difficult, you know, insightful, tyrannical teachers, you know. He was a very tyrannical guy. Probably, on the whole, for the long term, they should be, you know, should do a little sabbatical with that kind of teacher and then come back to the boring one, you know. It's probably the best, you know. But and that's the other point to make about all of this, is it would be really good, you know, for all of us, you know, at some point or other, to do some practice in another place, you know, with a different style. You know, like there's the Zen Center in Northern Oregon. That's only 4 or 5 hours drive away. Maybe we should do a little Sangha trip down there. Their teachers have a little different style and practice a little bit different style. That's where Fran Hecht practiced. Or even a totally different, you know, lineage, or, you know, go to retreat at Shambhala Center or something, you know. Just because the sort of downside of this style of sort of steadiness and unimpressiveness is one's practice can become a little dull, you know what I mean? You can sort of lose that sense of liveliness and creativity, which is a key constituent of practice as well. So anyway, it's probably good to occasionally go get some dramatic teaching from somebody, but yeah, not all the time. In fact, I got a dramatic teaching from the teacher at Zen Community of Oregon, from the Oregon group, at dinner. Here, I'll tell you another story. Now I'm on a roll. Norman had not long before asked me to ordain, me and Florence Kaplow, which really surprised us. You know, we thought we were nowhere good enough for that, but he convinced us, and you know, we trust him, so we were getting ready to do that. And I was starting to go around it was after this. So it must have been sort of 6 months after Norman said that, I was at a retreat in Vancouver They had chosen Bays up, the teacher of the Zen community of Oregon, and they often go out to dinner, like it's sort of a big city song, you know what I mean? So part of the practice is going out to dinner in like these noisy Chinese restaurants, you know, with like 30 people. You can't, it's kind of terrible actually, you can't have any conversations, you know, it's just like, but anyway, so I happened to be seeing, but I was sitting next to her, or maybe it was on the way into the restaurant or something like that. Somebody told her, or maybe I told her, yeah, I'm going to ordain, and you know, isn't that cool, you know, just like making conversation. It's probably me, you know, ordain. And she turned to me and said, what? How are you going to practice? Like, she didn't get it. She's like, what? This makes no sense. You know, you're up here. You're not in a monastery. You know, she had a little different attitude about training. And I was really, like, sort of floored, you know what I mean? Really sort of upset, you know? And it's just the smallest little thing that she said, you know? But it was just her expressing from her point of view without sort of hesitating or worrying about my feelings or, you know what I mean? Just like, what? Why is this? You know, she was curious, too. She's like, well, how could that make sense? I don't... And, you know, she wasn't, like, negative about it. She was just like, what? And I really didn't have a good answer because at that time, I didn't really understand the training I was already doing, you know what I mean? I didn't realize, well, you know, the answer was, well, every Thursday at 6:30, I stop what I'm doing, you know what I mean? Or Wednesday or whatever night, you know, Thursday then. I go to the Dharma Hall. I open the Dharma Hall. I sit zazen. I talk to people. I go to a meeting, you know. And then the next week I do it all over again. And I plan to, you know, and I've done, and I'll do that for 20 or 30 or 40 years, you know, see if I can learn something. You know, that's my training, but I don't know where I'm going with this. But just to have somebody sort of question your understanding, you know, is helpful. Helps you clarify, get you upset. Anyway. Basta, mis amigas y amigos. Bueno.